The first people to inhabit the Americas came from northern Asia. Over centuries, they walked across a stretch of land that no longer exists, as it is now covered by the wide waters of the Bering Strait. People came in at the far northwestern corner of North America, and over time, they spread to the tip of South America. The Columbus Day holiday marks a relatively recent arrival in this continent's history. It was only 526 years ago when an aggressive, expansionist, European Old World made contact with a varied set of indigenous worlds, the Old Worlds of the Americas. Setting aside the particular actions of Christopher Columbus as a person, what is important to me about the first contact in 1492 is to consider the history of colonial and native encounters that followed it. For the United States, these encounters have included the forced removal of people who have been in the way of what the powerful have named progress. These encounters have included the brutal suppression of native resistance by white settlers, law enforcement, and the military. The stories of suppression of indigenous people are similar in other countries and continents, including Australia, Africa, and South America. In addition to the physical suffering and lives lost, we must also remember the theft of people's sense of culture, belonging, and well-being. This is known as symbolic violence. For indigenous people, the trauma of relocation includes the loss of connections to land formations, plants and animals, weather patterns, traditional foods, and the artistic and cultural practices that come from a sense of place. To remove a people's culture by force is to commit symbolic violence. As a congregation here, we seek to be a force for healing in the world. One step toward that is to understand the history that caused such a great need for healing in the world. I'd like to mention a few things that I've learned about the people who called these lands their own long before the U.S. was a country. What is most striking is how much I had never learned or never considered before. Most of us who are white have no cause or incentive to learn about non-white people or cultures. Many people of color, on the other hand, have no choice but to learn about the white culture of this country because it's everywhere. It is seen as the norm, as the center of all experience. For people on the margins, knowing the dominant culture is essential to their success and their survival. The tribes and nations in California are distinct from one another, especially in language. Natives living in California have represented more than 90 separate languages, coming from 6 basic language groups. I learned this on a visit to the State Indian Museum near Sutter's Fort in Sacramento. The museum says it is important to understand that Native cultures are current and ongoing. Native people lived here long ago, but still live here today, and some in increasing numbers. Between 1904 and 1936, the U.S. government established 54 Indian settlements in California. These are called rancherias. Right now, there are 59 rancherias. In addition, throughout the United States, there are 310 federal Indian reservations. A reservation is managed by a tribe or nation under the government's Bureau of Indian Affairs. In addition, many people of Native descent live in cities and towns outside of reservations and rancherias. According to Sacramento's Native American Health Center, between 1952 and 1972, over 100,000 reservation Indians went through the relocation program of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They resettled in metropolitan areas, including this one. In Sacramento County, 1.5% of the population identifies as Native. For a decade, I have driven to Patwin Road, west of downtown Davis, to visit our sibling Unitarian Universalist congregation there. Now I know that Patwin Road was named for the Patwin people who have resided in and come from that area. For years, I heard about Esalen, the retreat center and spa on the coast of Big Sur, with workshops for spiritual growth and renewal. Now I know the name comes from the Esalen tribe of people who have lived in that area since long before the Institute was founded. In the mountains 12 miles east of the Institute, there are pictographs on the walls of caves, pictographs that are 4,000 years old. Right here, we are in the middle of land inhabited for a long time by the Nisenan, or Southern Maidu people. Among other things you can learn at the Maidu Museum and Historic Site in Roseville is how the Nisenan people and others in the Maidu language group have ground acorns into flour, providing a nourishing staple for their diet. Many of us appreciate the varieties of oak trees in this area. We love their size and endurance and the beauty of their branches and leaves. Their acorns are like works of art, a perfect image of autumn. Until now, I hadn't thought of acorns as food, but for the Maidu, they have been key to their survival. Unitarian Universalism is an open religious heritage. We have always asserted that we don't know all the answers about faith, God, human purpose, or the meaning of life. Yet until recent decades, denominational officials in our heritage have been pretty sure how the world ought to be run. One story about an Indian school makes that point for me. In the 1880s, the U.S. government contracted with religious denominations and missionary groups to build and manage schools close to Indian reservations. For 9 years, the American Unitarian Association ran a school on the Crow Indian Reservation. We called it the Montana Industrial School at Ramona Ranch. Like many of the contract schools, this one would teach girls about homemaking and boys about farming, cattle raising, and technical trades. Explaining the non-academic orientation of the school, the Unitarian leader in Boston, Samuel A. Eliot, said, quote, "Indians as a race are inferior intellectually to white men." Hence, he said, the goal for the school was not to make Indian scholars, but for Indians to learn useful skills and how to be good, moral, civilized people. In Massachusetts, the denomination recruited a Unitarian minister and his wife to make the journey to Montana, build a school, hire teachers, and work with government agents to recruit students. This couple, the Reverend Henry Bond and Pamela Bond, sacrificed for this mission. They lived simply in small quarters at the ranch. Yet their hard work and good intentions were fueled by a sense of cultural superiority as well as compassion. Writing to Boston about his first group of 30 students, Henry Bond said, "They are all promising. How such good-appearing fellows came from an ignorant, lazy, squalid, orphaned race is a constant surprise to us." The Montana Industrial School was a boarding school. Free education, free housing, and free meals for the students. Bond announced that Indian parents could visit their children at the school, but he alerted them that the parents would not be fed or allowed to stay overnight. Back at the reservation, Crow families were malnourished and hungry, so this denial was more than an emotional hardship. It was a physical one. Indeed, if some parents on the reservation would refuse to enroll their kids in the school, the U.S. government agent would threaten to refuse their food rations at home. Feeling homesick at their boarding school, some of the kids ran away from it. Others refused to come back after a summer vacation, which was 2 weeks in July. After a few years, the Bonds received a new teacher by the name of George Pease. Pease was a Crow person himself. Pease and the Bonds became close, having conversations about Crow theology and tribal culture. Thanks to Pease's guidance, the Bonds decided to build an additional building next to the school in which the pupils' parents could gather to visit and stay overnight, smoke, and eat with their children. Following this, Reverend Bond scheduled regular days for families to make visits to the school, making use of that building. A few more good glimmers of our Unitarian heritage did appear at this time. For example, U.S. government agents made inspections of the school. In 1888, the Unitarians were criticized by the inspectors for not having the children in classrooms 5 to 6 hours a day, as was required. They were criticized also for not using the prescribed textbooks. Reverend Bond defended his hardworking teacher, Miss Crosby. She was an excellent teacher, and the students learned just as much outside the classroom as within it. Such a radical idea had been popular with some of New England's Unitarians. There is more to learn than you can get from books or sitting all day at a desk. Yet perhaps that radical new idea of ours was just old wisdom for the Crow Indians. During these years, white settlers began grazing their cattle on the reservation land without paying the Crow tribe for the use of the land. When the Crow protested this trespassing in 1887, the government said the grazing was legal and allowable. Author Helen Olive writes that the making of treaties has a spiritual aspect, a commitment of honor, and a show of trust. Yet in the interest of land and mineral wealth, the United States has violated its trust and its honor many times. The government entered into more than 500 treaties with Indian nations between 1778 and 1871. Every one of them, Olive writes, was broken, changed, or nullified when it served the government's interests to do so. In 1868, for example, the government made a treaty to leave the Black Hills of South Dakota in the possession of the Indian tribes. However, just a few years later, gold was discovered on those lands. In 1874, General George Custer made a 1,000-mile expedition from Nebraska with 1,000 troops, infantry, cavalry, and artillery, to put down the resistance of Western tribes to the mining on their lands. Hence, by 1876, more than 7,000 non-Indians had begun mining in the Black Hills. David Archambault is the current tribal chair, for the Standing Rock Sioux in the Dakotas. Looking back at more than a century of broken promises and violations of tribal dignity, he writes, "Whether it is gold from the Black Hills, or hydroelectric power from the Missouri River, or oil pipelines that threaten our ancestral inheritance, the tribes have always paid the price for America's prosperity." The tribes have always paid the price for America's prosperity. The Montana Industrial School continued under Unitarian leadership for 9 years until 1895. Then U.S. government agents took over the management of all of the reservation schools. No doubt, during and after that school's existence, some of our Unitarian ancestors defended and rationalized their efforts to assimilate Native children to white culture. After all, the dominant culture was destroying the Indian way of life. Territorial expansion and economic development for minerals were taking away their lands. The white decision makers perhaps considered assimilation to be the key to survival for non-white people. Yet it might have been more courageous and more useful for them to help Indians protect their lands and preserve their ways of life, which had held Native communities together for centuries. What if, rather than seeing a duty to be responsible white patrons, the men in charge of the American Unitarian Association had seen the option of being white allies? They did not see that as an option or an opportunity or pursue it. But in our time, as Native tribes continue to struggle to keep their sovereignty, protect their water supplies, honor their culture, we do have opportunities to provide support. For example, in 2016, hundreds of Unitarian Universalists responded to an invitation by the water protectors of the Standing Rock Sioux to show up for a long winter protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The pipeline threatens to desecrate sacred lands of the tribe, to contaminate its sources of fresh water, and ruin animal habitats and landscapes. At least 50 of our UU clergy showed up, along with non-minister UUs, plus groups from other faith traditions who went. Indians from hundreds of other tribes went also to join the Standing Rock Water Protectors. This generated unprecedented cooperation and solidarity among Native communities. In the standoff, military and police force and industrial machinery were met with prayers and nonviolent resistance. One of the ministers who went there was the Reverend Kristen Grassel Schmidt from the UU Church of Berkeley. In recalling her time there, Kristen honored the leadership and the spiritual courage of the water protectors. She said, "Never once did I hear any of them, whether in personal conversation or from a microphone, speak with hatred toward the police who have been injuring them, or toward the Americans whose greed for wealth and hunger for oil have crippled the natural resources of this continent." Their witness humbled her, she said. It gave her hope. In June of 2017, our congregation hosted a forum right here, and it was entitled Native Voices and Earth Justice. The lead speaker was Penny Opal Plant, a Native American activist from the Bay Area. A year ago in September, four people from this congregation went on one of the healing walks in the Bay Area refinery corridor. Led by Native Americans, these healing walks in the refinery area include prayers and conversations about the issues of clean air, water and soil, safe workplaces, children's health, and moving toward sustainable energy practices. Here at UUSS, our Interfaith Earth Justice team is keeping us informed of new opportunities to learn as well as to show up in support of environmental justice. There is an opportunity next Saturday right here. We will gather at UUSS in the morning, and then volunteers will go out as teams to canvass neighbors in the west part of this Arden Arcade neighborhood. Working with interfaith companions through Sacramento Area Congregations Together, volunteers will ask our neighbors about the issues affecting where they live and work. Things like poverty and safety and the need for a healthy environment. We will help them to register to vote and encourage them to vote on or before November 6. When systems of oppression can seem overwhelming, it is good to remember the ways that we can make a difference together. Day by day and one step at a time, it is possible to join with others to be a force for healing in the world. If you are able to attend on Saturday, that would be great. If you're not, there will be other ways to help. Please remember that all the ways that you support this congregation will help all of us to put our values into action together. With curiosity, let us keep learning about our heritage, our community, and ourselves. With respect and openness, let us learn from the perspectives of leaders from Indigenous and other local communities. Let us honor their leadership. And with humility, let us practice learning how to be a force for healing in the world. So may it be. Blessed be. Amen.